All rise. The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary S. Katzman, Timothy M. Reif, and Jane A. Rustani presiding. Before court number 25-00091, Axel of Dearborn, Inc. versus the United States Department of Commerce et al. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
Tom Dupree on behalf of Detroit Axel.
Good afternoon.
Connor Moy for Detroit Axel.
Eric Hamilton for defendants.
Afternoon.
Taylor Bates for U.S. Customs and Border Protection.
Thank you. You may be seated. Good afternoon. As you see, seated to my right is Jeff Rustani. And as you hear on screen is Judge Timothy Reif, who is actually appearing before us. He's in North Carolina, District of North Carolina, sitting by designation. We are here in this case, Axel of Dearborn versus Department of Commerce, a case involving the use of IEPA to suspend the de minimis exemption for goods valued at less than $800, as codified in 19 U.S.C. Section 1321. As the parties know, we previously held oral argument in this case on July 10th, 2025, and subsequently denied Axel's request for a preliminary injunction in light of the relief we had already granted in two related cases, VOS Selections versus United States and Oregon versus United States, cases challenging the president's use of IEPA to impose tariffs. We then stayed the case pending the resolution of VOS and Oregon in the Federal Circuit and later at the Supreme Court. We will now proceed with the argument. Now, I understand, Mr. Dupree, you'll be arguing first.
Yes, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court, Tom Dupree on behalf of the plaintiff, Detroit Axel.
And you're reserving time, I understand?
Yes, I have reserved 5 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The question before this court is whether IEPA authorizes the president to override a congressionally enacted statute and nullify the de minimis exemption. We believe that Learning Resources answers this question. The Supreme Court has resolved the question that this court is considering today. In fact, we think that the argument the government is advancing today is even more aggressive than the argument that it presented and was rejected in Learning Resources. And that's because here, the government is not only trying to effectively impose tariffs under IEPA, but in the process, it is also purporting to override three distinct congressional statutes. Let me start with Learning Resources. As this court knows, in Learning Resources, the Supreme Court said that IEPA does not authorize the president to raise revenue through tariffs. And that's what's happening here.
Doesn't Learning Resources say any new additional duties or tariffs under IEPA are invalid? We're talking about a duty that was already in place. It was reduced or suspended by Congress, but no new additional tariffs are being imposed by the executive. Isn't that correct?
Well, Your Honor is correct that the Learning Resources case did involve a challenge to new tariffs. But I think for today's purposes, what's most relevant is the court's holding, which is that IEPA does not authorize the president to, and this is the court's words, raise revenue through tariffs. The other point I would make, Your Honor, is that even if the court thinks, well, because that case involved imposing tariffs, this case concerns nullifying an exemption, even though I think the two are functionally equivalent. But even if the court sees a distinction between the two of those, I think the reasoning that led to the holding in Learning Resources is equally compelling and requires the same outcome and conclusion here. In Learning Resources, the court focused on several aspects of IEPA that led it to conclude the president lacked the power he claimed. For one thing, it pointed out that IEPA doesn't mention the word tariffs. For another thing, it pointed out that when Congress—
does explicitly mention any privilege. And the statute repeatedly refers to the de minimis provision as a privilege, doesn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. It does refer to the de minimis exemption as a privilege, but I don't think it is a plausible reading to interpret IEPA's power to nullify or void privileges as encompassing the de minimis privilege, a statutory privilege that's at issue in this case. For one thing, we know from what the Supreme Court said in Learning Resources is that when Congress wishes to vest the executive with an extraordinary power,
Doesn't IEPA say any privilege? How are you coming up with your narrowing of the term any privilege to something that, in your view, is not what you call a statutory privilege?
Well, the Supreme Court has said that when the word any appears in the statute, it has to be read in context. It does not automatically, in all cases, mean every single one of the category. And I don't think, I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't think even the government would say that IEPA gives the president the power to nullify any right or privilege. I would be surprised if the government's position is that IEPA gave the president to nullify, say, a constitutional right, like the right to due process, or a constitutional privilege.
But I think there's general agreement that the president can impose embargoes. And so if the president said, drugs are coming in from China, it's just terrible, it's an extraordinary problem, I declare an emergency, I now embargo all goods from China.
The president has the embargo power, but this is not an embargo case.
Well, this is a lot narrower than an embargo. You mean he can do something infinitely greater under the statute, but he can't do the narrow.
That's what we're saying, Your Honor, but I think that's the correct position. It was the position that was embraced by a majority of the Supreme Court. That, Your Honor's point, kind of the greater includes the lesser. That was the point that divided the majority and the dissent in Learning Resources. It was Justice Kavanaugh's dissent where he said, oh, the greater includes the lesser. And so the majority considered that exact argument and rejected it. Keep in mind that in Learning Resources, the government also made that same, this is just an embargo or a quota argument, and the Supreme Court rejected it there too.
Well, it clearly was not just an embargo. I mean, it was a wholesale rewriting of the HTSUS. This doesn't even come close to the HTSUS. There's really nothing that changes in the HTSUS because of this.
Well, I think that what is changing is the law that Congress enacted and enshrined in the United States Code. It, number one, requires the existence of a de minimis exemption. And number two, it specifically provides in subsection B that if the executive branch wishes to modify the de minimis exemption, make exceptions to the exemption, it has to follow a notice and comment rulemaking process.
Yes, it does, unless IEPA applies. Do you have anything to say about the House report for the big, beautiful bill, which says, the House report says no section of this provision should be interpreted. That's when they set a specific date for termination of the de minimis in the big, beautiful bill. And it says no section of this provision should be interpreted to diminish existing authorities of the president to enforce U.S. laws by limiting the availability of the administrative exemption under 321. Including to protect the revenue or to prevent unlawful importation. By repealing the statute providing this exemption, the committee is in no way modifying or undermining actions the president has already taken or may take in the future to restrict the availability of the administrative exemption prior to the repeal date. That is in the House Report 19-106 at 1768 for the big, beautiful bill. It says, we thunk about it, and we're not affecting the president's rights under IEPA.
Well, look, I think one thing the Supreme Court has said is that Congress speaks through the statutes that it enacts, not through a Senate report.
You know what? I'm not a firm. There are people who will never cite legislative history anytime, anywhere for any purpose. My view is I'll get all the help I can get from wherever. And that seems to me some help on the legislative intent of the big, beautiful bill providing for an ending in July 27.
Well, if what this comes down to is the government having legislative history on their side and my having statutory language on their side, I would bet on me. And what Congress said is that de minimis stays in place, again, according to the One Beautiful Bill Act, until July of 2027. They did that for a very sensible reason, because as we actually explored this point the last time we were all together, that businesses construct their business operations around the existence of de minimis. It's not something that they can turn on and off
overnight.
You know,
this is an argument I don't want to hear from any side. Great policy, bad policy. This is a policy argument that it would be better if we had de minimis that exists at a certain time and ends at a certain time and everybody knows about it 10 years ahead. I would love that. I think that's great policy. But guess what? I'm not making any policy.
Well, I take the point, Your Honor, and I'm not trying to make a purely policy-based argument, but what I would focus on is the text of the statute, the One Beautiful Bill Act, which says that it phases out effective July 2027. We can put aside the reasons why it did that, but certainly I think we could all agree that the fact that that phase-out date appears in the text of the statute Congress enacted at least is illustrative of Congress's intent that this not be deleted or evaporate overnight. And the point I'm simply making is that if, I think that's the only possible conclusion you can draw from that statutory text, if Congress did intend that, it did so for a very sensible reason.
Well, you know, if I didn't have this legislative history, I might say I have a Youngstown problem. But I do have this legislative history. I think this is where Congress has said, we're doing this, but we understand there's another statute and we're not messing with that other statute.
Well, again, when you say Congress said that, I would respectfully
quarrel with that. Okay, the legislative history says that's our intent in this big, beautiful bill.
To speak within the circle of trust. It was a Senate staffer who probably put that language in the Senate report. It's not the words of Congress. Those are not democratically enacted words that went through bicameralism and presentment. It's a 23-year-old kid on the hill who put that sentence in there.
If you have a statute that isn't clear, then you look to legislative history. I find this an unclear statute.
Well, we may have to respectfully disagree. My view is if they say de minimis phases out in July 2027, I take that to mean de minimis phases out in July 2027, not in February 2025 or whenever they claim that it phased out.
Right. Well, talking about legislative history, cite to the 1941 amendment to the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917 to argue that the language at issue here, authorizing the president to void any privilege, broadened the president's authority to seize, not just freeze, as he could before, alien property. Is the power to seize property the only authority that Congress intended to convey in the 1941 amendment to the Trading with the Enemy Act that added the relevant language?
Let's see, I'm not sure. There could have been other authorities. That certainly is the one that we identified and we focused on. But I think that to me, the salient point of kind of that whole legislative history backdrop is that what Congress then and now, and when it included the language that currently appears in IEEPA, what it was focused on was foreign-owned property. Those are the words that appear in the statute. Those are words that my good friends on the other side have carefully ignored throughout this litigation, that to the extent the president has power under IEEPA, and even if we grant them their wildest, broadest presidential power that they dreamed of under IEEPA, it still is confined to foreign-owned property. That's in the statutory text. And the fact that IEEPA confines its presidential authority to foreign-owned property means that they can't effect a wholesale repeal of de minimis. Could they repeal it just limited to foreign-owned property? I mean, at least in their view, yes. Maybe arguably, yes. Again, if you accept everything they're saying today. But there is no universe in which they can claim that the president has IEEPA power over property that is not foreign-owned. I will be very interested to hear what my friends have to say about that, because we have been beating this drum throughout this case, and we have yet to have an answer about what they do with that foreign property limitation on the president's powers. If I could respond to one question, Judge Rustani, you had mentioned earlier where we had been talking about the 1321B power to modify de minimis, and Your Honor said something like, well, that's only if we assume that AIPA doesn't cover it. What I would say is, even if you agree with the government's broad understanding of AIPA, I think that makes this a classic textbook case for application of the Radlax Gateway case in the Supreme Court. That's the classic case where the Supreme Court gave the general and specific rule that if you have two statutes that arguably are in conflict and you don't know which one to apply, the court must apply the more specific one rather than the more general one. This is a textbook case for application of that fundamental canon of construction. There can be no dispute that 1321B, the process for which the Congress said the administration, the executive branch, can make changes to de minimis, that specifies the exact process for doing what they're trying to do here. They cannot come back and point to language that is broad in subsection AIPA about nullifying all rights and privileges in the world. They can't rely on that general statute when Congress enacted a more specific statute and one that is identical to what's going on in this case. You couldn't draw up a more specific statute for this case.
I'd like to ask a couple technical questions. You didn't file any surreply. I think there was a late argument from the government that PGA requirements applied. Did you get some kind of registration for your customers in order for them to observe the PGA requirements?
Right. I believe what this is, Your Honor, referring to the argument that we were bringing in parts that were subject to NHTSA regulations.
Exactly. Right.
This is immensely frustrating for me and for my client, because this issue was fully and finally resolved 4 years ago. NHTSA and the government approached us and said, hey, we're wondering, is this stuff subject to NHTSA's jurisdiction or these parts? You don't qualify for de minimis. We retained counsel. We went back and forth. Ultimately, we got written confirmation from NHTSA saying we do not regulate these parts. This issue is over.
So how come you just didn't tell us this after the government put this in their reply?
Well,
there's something called a surreply. There's something called, you know, information to the court. I've been trying to figure this thing out, and you didn't say boo.
Well, Your Honor, I wish we had, but all I can say is if we had to file sir replies on all the points we took issue with in their reply brief, would
this was the only thing in which you wouldn't be entitled to file a sir reply, because it was a new argument.
Fair enough, Your Honor, and I apologize for us not bringing it to the court's attention. But that's the short answer: is that we resolved this with NHTSA. We got written confirmation from NHTSA that this didn't apply.
Okay, so you were using what do you call it? Release from manifest methods to get in. And release from manifest means we get the goods from the manifest, not, okay, it's a kind of weird ruling. But as I understand it, all you need is the manifest and you get the goods released by means of the manifest. And that's what you use.
That's my understanding.
Okay.
Yes.
Can I ask you a quick question about non-delegation?
Yes.
And that goes to the Field case. As you know, in Field, the Supreme Court noted that the legislature cannot delegate its power to make a law, but it can make a law to delegate a power to determine some fact or state of things upon which a law makes or intends to make its own actions depend. If you could discuss or explain that, you know, does a reading by AIPA that allows the president to rescind the de minimis exemption qualify as a permissible delegation of power to determine an underlying condition or an impermissible delegation of power to make a law? I'm going to ask the government the same question.
Sure. And the short answer is, if that is how this court were to interpret AIPA, it would render it an unconstitutional delegation. But with regard to the Marshall Fields case and the Tariff Act of 1890, I think what those older authorities illustrate is precisely how the Congress could affect a permissible delegation. In other words, what the Tariff Act of 1890 tells us, and as the court knows, this was also explored in the Clinton versus New York case, where what...
And was not overturned.
Well, the law, you know, those cases weren't overturned. The line item veto was overturned.
Right.
But I think what...
Field was not overturned.
That's correct. Mm. But I think if you look at the Field case, and again, I use the 1890 Tariff Act because I think it is very similar it is similar to what the government, Congress could have done here, but did not do here, which is to say, if it is going to make a permissible delegation, it needs to delegate with specificity the precise tariff that would be overturned, the conditions that would happen. For example, in the 1890 Tariff Act, that was a statute that said there are certain exemptions for, I think it was like coffee and molasses and some other goods. And if the president makes those determinations, then he will eliminate the exemptions as to those particular goods. That type of statute, specific, narrowly focused, that specifies both the conditions and what happens and the statutes, the particular tariffs that would be adjusted, it's like the coffee tariff and the molasses tariff, that is the antithesis of the quote-unquote delegation.
About the national security, what is it, 1832, whatever the name of that, whatever that statute that's been upheld, where all it says is, you know, the president thinks of the national security, it's good for the economy, he can put this tariff on. And that's been upheld by the Supreme Court and Algonquin and I don't know. And did they ever get the other case? I guess they didn't. I think they denied cert in that. But in the Algonquin case, they upheld it. I mean, all he has to do is basically... Even if the Department of Defense says we don't need this for defense, a hit to the economy is good enough.
But what's happening here is that...
Isn't that what that case does? That's a whole lot more general than we're going to, under a generalized system of preferences, remove this or remove that. It's a pretty general grant of authority to the president, which Congress says was specific enough. I mean, Supreme Court says was specific enough. Although we're dubious about that.
Yeah. Dubitante, right. Yeah.
I think there's also an important distinction, though, between granting the president the power to, say, impose tariffs in kind of a blank slate context versus overriding, erasing, and nullifying statutes that exist. That was the thing that really focused the Supreme Court in the Clinton versus New York case, is that what the court said was, look, we have a process specified in the United States Constitution for making law, and it has to be followed. And can there be slight deviations? Could Congress enact a statute that gives the president subsequently to modify the contours of the statute? The Supreme Court gave a grudging yes. It said yes, but its key point was it has to be specific, it has to be narrow, and it has to be qualified. That's what IEEPA is missing. You could not draft a statute that just has more vague, capacious terms than rights, privileges, void, nullify, prevent. Again, it is the polar opposite of the type of specific, particular statute that Congress, the Supreme Court has said Congress must enact in order to effect a constitutional delegation. I will reserve my time.
Thank you. Mr. Hamilton.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Eric Hamilton for the defendants. Since taking office, President Trump has signed a number of executive orders that have suspended the de minimis exemption. These orders were signed under authority vested in the president by the Congress in the IEEPA statute. And that statute confers on the president an authority to nullify, void, prevent, or prohibit the exercise.
Can I ask something about the specific executive orders? I kind of understand why the de minimis relates, deals with whatever, however you want to say it, synthetic opioid importation. But he also did it under the balance of payments and reciprocal tariffs and all that other stuff. Are you relying on those or just the fentanyl executive orders?
Yes, it is both national emergencies. This IEEPA action does deal with the national emergency.
Suppose we thought, well, it doesn't really deal with the national emergency of balance of payments, but suppose we thought it's plausible for the president to do this with relating to drugs. If we had that dichotomy in our brains, would we still uphold it?
I think so, but there's a fundamental problem, which is that issue is not before the court.
You're right.
The plaintiffs have
not raise it.
That argument, exactly. And
did not raise it.
Yes. And it also is not judicially reviewable.
I know you guys say that, but, you know, I have the view that if it's total nonsense, it doesn't work. I think it's a hard case to make that the drug cap is total nonsense. But they did not raise it.
Exactly. So it is not part of the issues that are presented for the court today. And the IEPA orders are the suspension of the de minimis exemption is consistent with the IEPA statute's authority to nullify, void, prevent, or prohibit the exercise of a privilege. And as was noted in my friend on the other side's argument, the statute, section 321, is express in saying that this exemption is a privilege. My friend argues that that word ought to be construed as only affecting common law privileges. But IEPA's text answers that that construction is wrong. IEPA says it's any privilege. And my friend on the other side's interpretation would make right, power, and privilege redundant if all of that really is just collapsed into how a property owner exercises some measure of control over property. Privilege in IEPA includes administrative exemptions that Congress has called privileges.
So if I could also ask you the question, counsel, regarding the 1941 amendment to the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917. Axel argues that the language authorizing the president to void any privilege broadened the president's authority to seize, not just freeze, as he could before alien property. Is the power to seize property the only authority that Congress intended to convey in the 1941 amendment to TWIA that added the relevant language?
I must confess, I don't remember all the particulars of the TWIA statute here, but I think what is very clear from the IEPA statute is that the authority goes well beyond a seizure power in using multiple words to confer expansive emergency authority on the president. And it's enough for the orders that the plaintiff has challenged that this statute states that the president can nullify or void the exercise of a privilege, which is exactly what these executive orders have done.
Can I also bring you to the non-delegation doctrine? And Marshall Field and Cook versus Clark, where the Supreme Court stated that it cannot be said that the exercise of discretion is the making of the law. Is the president here doing more than exercising his discretion?
No, the president is exercising discretion that IEPA confers in him to take emergency action of a limited duration. And he is taking this action against an administrative privilege that the Congress has authorized the Department of Homeland Security to create. So this is a very different case.
Before the big, beautiful bill, was there any limitation on these executive orders? I didn't get that they were limited in time. You said a limited period. It wasn't for a limited period, was it?
Well, every IEPA order is limited to the period of the national emergency. So if, for example, during the congressional review process for national emergencies, the emergency were terminated, that is the basis for the president's IEPA action, then the authority that was exercised and rests on that emergency, it fades away as well.
So it's 2 years or something? I can't remember what the period was for Congress to take action.
There's a time limit in the statute, and the emergencies are subject to renewal. But the bottom line point here is that this is an emergency authority, And it is by definition of a temporary one for the duration of the emergency. That's why these are suspensions of the de minimis exemption.
Returning for a moment to Marshall Field and Company versus Clark, and you heard your brother's argument. In Marshall Field, the Supreme Court upheld the president's power to suspend import duty exemptions because this suspension was contingent on a condition that did not predate its statute. The duty to suspend was absolute once the president determined the contingency had arisen and the suspension executed congressional policy. Does the president's power to rescind the de minimis exemption have those same three qualities?
Well, I would start with the IEPA statute. I mean, the answer is yes. The IEPA statute gives the president a power to deal with an unusual and extraordinary foreign threat to the national security, foreign policy, or economy of the United States during a national emergency. And President Trump identified and declared a national emergency after the statute was enacted. His declaration is consistent with the statute, although, as noted earlier with Judge Rustani, the plaintiff here has not made any challenge to the validity of the national emergency. And that's enough for the IEPA statute.
Clarify for me exactly how long does the national emergency exist? Because we had the problem with the one house veto that went away, right? So
my recollection is that the national emergencies are by default for 1 year.
Okay.
But it might have been 2 years. Again, the plaintiff here hasn't made any sort of challenge arising out of the National Emergencies Act component of IEPA.
Yeah, I'm just trying to make sure I'm on first. Okay. I'm at first base before I get to home run here. All right.
I'll touch also on the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. There's nothing about this statute that somehow operates against IEPA. When the One Big Beautiful Bill Act was passed by the Congress and signed into law by the president had already suspended the de minimis exemption as to China. And it's simply impossible to construe what the Congress did and the president signed into law as implicitly rescinding the president's IEPA executive order. If the Congress had intended to do what my friend on the other side urges, Congress could have added into the One Big Beautiful Bill Act some amendment to the IEPA statute or some amendment to 1321 that would take effect before July 2027. Did nothing like that. It, against the backdrop of the president already having signed an IEPA executive order suspending the de minimis privilege, left that exercise of authority undisturbed.
Opposing counsel says a legislative history doesn't mean anything. What do you think of that piece of legislative history?
I mean, it's very much on point. It refutes my friend's argument. And it's certainly true that courts will, in some cases, resort to legislative history to resolve ambiguities. Here, of course, the text itself.
I know.
Clearly,
you say it's unambiguous in your direction, and he says it's unambiguous in his direction. So forget legislative history. Okay.
I don't say forget legislative history. I think that is a very relevant piece of information for the court to consider in construing the statute. But here, in addition to the legislative history, we have the text and the context of the timing of the One Big Beautiful Act's passage by the Congress and signature by the president, which is consistent with our arguments that IEPA includes this authority to suspend the de minimis privilege.
You know, I had trouble. Go ahead, Judge Rife. I can't get any signals from you because I can't see you. So please go ahead.
No, you finish your line of questioning and then I'll jump in.
No, you go ahead.
Go ahead, Judge Reif, please.
Counsel, I don't think you're the point you're making is your strongest with respect to the passage by Congress of the statute, because it could be read to be a direct contradiction to the president's first action with respect to the de minimis. So I'm not sure you want to rest a lot of weight on that. But tell me, how do you respond to the foreign property argument of the plaintiffs?
Well, I'm very surprised to hear my friend on the other side raise this, because it's not something that Axel affirmatively argues in its papers. In footnote one of its motion, it says it reserves the right to press this argument, but I don't read their papers to lean very hard into this argument. But in substance, I would respond that AIPA's very broad emergency authority statute confers a power with respect to any property in which any foreign country or national thereof has any interest by any person or with respect to any property subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. So AIPA takes a very broad approach in fashioning this foreign affairs emergency power. And again, I don't think the plaintiff has pressed this argument in a way that it is properly presented before the court, with them reserving the right to argue it in a footnote in their motion.
Why isn't the executive's action here subject to notice and comment rulemaking?
Well, a few responses on that one. The executive acted here through AIPA and signed an again, this is an order responding to declarations of national emergencies. It would make no sense for every agency's implementation of an AIPA emergency order to go through the notice and comment process. But in addition, notice and comment does not apply to every agency action. There are exceptions, for example, for foreign affairs, and that would apply here if the inquiry even made it that far. But the relevant executive action here is not anything that CBP or DHS has done. It's the president's decision to exercise power pursuant to a statute that confers in him, not anyone else in the executive branch, presidential authority to respond to national emergencies in exercising AIPA authority. That exercise isn't subject to the Administrative Procedure Act and the processes that Congress created in that statute.
Can I ask a question about this affidavit you put in, even though I've disavowed any interest in policy? It says that because there's increases in seizures since the suspension of the de minimis exemption due to the additional data now required. Why does the additional data get you seizures? I didn't get any of that from the I can understand additional inspections getting you seizures, but why does additional data give you seizures?
I'm not sure I have much to add to the declarant's statement on that standing here right now, but I think the bottom line point we were trying to make, and I don't think it's an especially important point because, as Your Honor noted, this really isn't a case that rises and falls with policy. It's about the text of AIPA. But the point is that this executive action is, in fact, fulfilling the president's hope that it would improve public safety in the United States with respect to increased visibility into what is coming in through the United States import system and reduce abuse of release from manifest entries that come in connection with the de minimis privilege.
Can you address the release from manifest issue and sort of what counsel stated in terms of what happens here?
Yes, all of that is new information to us. We don't have any familiarity with that. So I don't have anything additional to provide beyond what we explained in our reply brief, which is our view that Axel should not have been importing auto goods that implicate NHTSA regulations through release from manifest. So,
I could not quite understand your argument. We're actually arguing there's no standing because they're not injured by the de minimis cessation.
To an extent.
I don't understand standing to an extent. There's either standing or there isn't.
Sure. But a plaintiff has to establish standing for every remedy that the plaintiff wants. As our declaration explains, there appears to be a very small number of instances where Axel itself is the importer of record or the consignee and is importing goods that may have entitled it to the de minimis exemption. But strange part of this case is that what Axel really wants is not the de minimis privilege for itself. Doesn't want the de minimis privilege to use.
No, once it wanted it at one point for its customers. For I don't know what customers. It wants now, but it did.
For its customers, exactly. And so to the extent that Axel is trying to use this lawsuit to give relief to importers who are not on the plaintiff's side of the V here,
You can see his injury argument from his business model. I don't think that's the big problem. Well, the problem is, if nobody, including his customers, were ever entitled to the de minimis privilege here, then he would have no claim. But he says that's not true. They worked this out. I was trying to figure out how I should read IEPA in with regard to this and how one would actually read it. So I was taking out the words and putting back in other words. And I guess I get down to the president may prevent or prohibit any exercising any privilege with respect to any property in which a foreign country or national thereof has an interest, da, da, da. So that was really weird. But that's the only way I could figure out. Prevent or prohibit any exercising any privilege. Is that it?
I would add nullify. Nullify, void, prevent, or prohibit exercising any privilege with respect to any property.
So nullify, void, prevent any exercising any privilege.
Yes. Yes, it's a very broad authority vested in the president to deal with emergencies, and it covers any privilege, not just common law privileges.
It just is very oddly written. I would say any exercising of any privilege, but I found the wording. It was hard for me to put ellipses in this thing and read it. And I was just wondering if you had a better way to do it.
No, I think that's it's a long statute. And I think that just highlights how hard Congress was working to ensure the president had wide flexibility to respond to national emergencies as he deems fit. And it very clearly includes authority to prevent exercising a privilege that Congress has said is a privilege in 1321. I'll make one brief point on the major questions doctrine does not apply here. I also want to respond to my friend's argument in briefing that the VOS en banc opinion controls. That would require turning a blind eye to the fact that when the exact same case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, only three justices agreed that the major questions doctrine applied there does not apply here.
What are you talking about?
Well, the VOS panel at the Federal Circuit, the en banc court, found that the major questions doctrine applied.
Okay. I see. I know what you're talking about. Now. Thank you.
Right. Judge Reif, do you have any questions at this time?
Thank you, Judge Cashman. No further questions for this witness.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You, as I understand, you will have five more minutes as well.
Thank you.
At the end. Honor. Yeah. Mr. Dupree.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few discrete points. First, on the specific.
Dupree, how do you respond to the government's response on the foreign property point that you made earlier?
Sure. Let's see. First, with regard to their suggestion that we never made this argument before, I would say we made it at paragraph 66 of our complaint. We made it in note 4 of our opening brief, and then we made it on page 10 of our response to their motion. These are cross motions for summary judgment, and so we're fully entitled to raise something by way of a response to a cross motion in the first instance. And on page 10 of our response, we said, IEPA only authorizes nullification of the exercising of a privilege with respect to foreign property, not the wholesale elimination of a general statutory command to exempt certain imports from tariffs. So we made the argument, but even if we hadn't made the argument, I think it would be unusual for a court to authorize what it might conclude is an unlawful exercise of presidential power because, well, the argument wasn't fully developed in the briefs. It was fully developed in the briefs.
Don't we have foreign property here within the clear meaning of IEPA?
Well, let's see. Number one, we don't have foreign-owned property in this case. So it wouldn't – that limitation would not authorize them applying the de minimis repeal to my client's situation. That's point number one. But point number two –
How do we not have foreign-owned – they're imports. How do we not have foreign-owned property? I don't understand.
Oh, because at the time the de minimis is applied, or at the time that the tariff hits, it's our property. In other words, it's the property of an American company. There's no foreign ownership in it at the time the goods come into the United States and the tariff is applied or not applied. The other point I wanted to make, and Judge Rafe, I did not hear, I might have missed it, I did not actually hear a substantive response as to why we're wrong on this point. And Judge Rustani, I take your point that the statute is, you know, can be challenging to parse, but there is plain language in it that says it applies only to foreign-owned property. And given that indisputable plain text in the statute, that language cannot authorize a wholesale repeal of de minimis.
Your argument of foreign property makes me think, why did the Supreme Court bother with all this stuff? They should have just said, you know, these are tariffs on, you know, importers. We have importers here. They own the property. It's not foreign property. That's not what the Supreme Court did. And that's not how anybody has ever thought of imports as being not foreign property. I just don't see that.
Well, I think, if we go back and we look at the history, as Judge Katzmann and I were exploring earlier, that foreign property hook, that comes out of the wake of Pearl Harbor, where Congress took action because they were concerned about foreign nationals or foreign countries that owned property. And so that's why they gave the president certain powers in that particular context. I think the Supreme Court, frankly, had no need to engage that issue because it just wiped out all of the tariffs in their entirety. It didn't need to say, well, actually, they would be okay if it's applied to foreign. They just said no tariffs, period. Our argument is that the limitation to foreign property, and Judge Rustani, this gets to your question where Your Honor focused on the words, the exercise of a privilege, that it didn't say that he can nullify a privilege. It said he can nullify the exercise of a privilege. Words have meaning. Congress uses those words deliberately. It said the exercise of a privilege because it contemplated that the nullification of the exercise of a privilege is something that would happen in individual cases, namely in individual cases involving foreign-owned property. If Congress wanted to give the president the power to eliminate de minimis wholesale, it would not have included those words, the exercise of. It would have just said he can nullify privileges, but it didn't say that. They want you to think that's what Congress said, but they didn't say that. If I could make one point on our second argument, which is the APA challenge, I don't want that to get lost in the shuffle because it is of equal dignity. It gives us a road to victory. And the other side has not disputed that if the APA applies, this is a patent violation of the APA. They didn't do notice and comment. They didn't provide a reasoned explanation. They didn't do all the things the APA requires.
If the president can't do what he did, then you have an APA
claim. That is true, Judge Rustani, but it goes beyond that. Even if the president had the authority under IEPA to issue the orders, the agency, when it issued the orders implementing them, violated the APA. That is a separate, independent.
Why could they? The president issues an executive order. They don't have any choice.
But the agency still had to issue orders implementing it, and the APA governs final agency action. No exceptions. That's what the Ninth Circuit said in the Nebraska versus Sioux case. It had almost identical issue just a few years ago where the government made the same argument it did here. It said, what choice did the agency have? It was ministerial. It was just implementing an executive order. And the Ninth Circuit said, nonsense. There's no ministerial exception to the APA. Counsel, that argument they are making was directly rejected by the Ninth Circuit.
Thank you, counsel. I think your time is up.
Thank you.
Mr. Hamilton.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll start with the argument about the foreign nature of the property at issue. I heard my friend on the other side say that IEPA is limited to foreign-owned property. That isn't at all what the statute says. It talks about foreign interests by any person. And that is, I think, very clearly what is happening here from what we understand about Axel's business with goods coming across the U.S.-Mexican border, arriving at this Mexican facility where I presume Mexican nationals and other foreign nationals work. And there is then on top of that, of course, the importation of goods from the People's Republic of China involving additional foreign nationals. It's not limited to ownership. It is instead a statute talking about interests. As for the Administrative Procedure Act, there is no way for Axel to litigate an APA claim in the context of an IEPA order where the statute is vesting decision-making authority in the President of the United States. The APA's text says its review mechanism is limited to agency action. That's Section 702. And then agency is defined in 701 in a statute that the Supreme Court interpreted in Franklin against Massachusetts to hold it doesn't include the President of the United States. My friend has urged the court to follow a divided Ninth Circuit opinion, but this court, of course, sits within the Federal Circuit. And the Federal Circuit, in the HMTX case, affirmed that, quote, actions involving discretionary authority delegated by Congress to the president are distinct from those involving authority delegated by Congress to an agency. And HMTX cites approvingly the Detroit International Bridge Company case from DDC, a frequently cited opinion on this subject that explains that agency action on behalf of the president involving discretionary authority committed to the president is unreviewable under the APA. And of course, if it were any other way, it would turn upside down the APA and the Congress's choice to not extend APA review to presidential decision making. Return to the text of IEPA, which clearly answers the question before the court of presidential authority to suspend the de minimis exemption. It's an authority to nullify, void, or prevent the exercise of any right, power, or privilege. 321 says that this exemption is a privilege, and that is where the analysis ends on the president's authority under IEPA. We ask the court would enter final judgment in the defendant's favor in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes our argument. Judge Reif, do you have anything else to say?
No, thank you, Judge Katzmann.
Thank you. Judge Rosani? Yeah, I didn't ask you about policy. I've learned that.
I had one question. You're seeking a money judgment?
Yes, among other things.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a money judgment because you had to pay to import stuff that your customers wouldn't have had to pay, and you think there's a cause of action for that?
Well, I know there's a cause of action for that.
How is there?
Well, it's a classic instance of an injury. In other words, we were injured by the president's unlawful action in repealing de minimis. We were injured by having to pay these tariffs. But for the unlawful action of the president, we wouldn't have paid those taxes, the tariffs.
Okay. I see your argument.
Well, okay. And if I do not wish to end on a note of skepticism, Judge Rustani, so maybe if I could just say a couple more words about it. In other words, when the unlawful order issued, we were given a Hobson's choice. The choice basically was shut down your business because no customers are going to pay with the heightened tariff on top of it, or absorb the tariff costs and pay them yourselves. That's why we suffered a financial injury. That's a classic case where this court has the power to order an award of money damages. But in addition to money damages, of course, we are also asking for vacator and we're asking for an injunction.
Okay. Well, you're in court, whatever. I don't know what the remedies are, but you're in court. So there you go.
Thank you very much for your arguments. We take it all under advisement. Safe travels. Take care.